There's no collusion, no override, and soon, no Udall and no Rahm. But yes, Virginia, there is a political junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. Trump reads the Attorney General's summary and proclaims a total victory. But the politics is just heating up.
I think this is going to be used by everybody to further this atmosphere we have of distrust and really contempt for the other side. And I think it's not just opposition. And you see that every day from President Trump. And the Democrats are starting to do the same thing.
Plus, history gets made next week in Chicago, which will get its first African-American female mayor.
It's a first that nobody really expected. They are both considered to be progressive candidates and talk about crime in the same way and talk about education in the same way, affordable housing. A lot of it has to do with who these folks are.
And we remember the historic milestone that took place at the 1984 Democratic Convention.
My name is Geraldine Ferraro. I stand before you to proclaim tonight, America is the land where dreams can come true for all of us.
It's all coming up on The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 270 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. President Trump was still enjoying his post-Mueller report victory high when the House on Tuesday gave him another gift. It failed to override his veto of the bill overturning his national emergency plan to divert federal money for his border wall. The vote was 248 to 181, with just 14 Republicans joining the rest of the Democrats on the override attempt, 20 votes short of the two-thirds needed. Trump's policy still faces court challenges. And New Mexico's Tom Udall became the first Democratic senator to opt out of a re-election bid for next year. Udall, first elected in 2008, correctly said that he probably would have won a third term.
In fact, I see these next 2 years as an incredible opportunity. Without the distraction of another campaign, I can get so much more done to help reverse the damage done to our planet, end the scourge of war, and to stop this president's assault on our democracy and our communities. These are three real crises that are happening right now and are threatening the very foundations of our great nation. If we don't do something, it will soon be too late.
Now comes the speculation on whom his successor might be. Topping the list on the Democratic side are House members Ben Ray Lujan, who's been in office for 10 years, and Deb Haaland, a freshman who last year became the first Native American woman ever elected to Congress. Also mentioned, Hector Balderas, the state attorney general, and Secretary of State Maggie Toulouse Oliver. As for the Republicans, the name that always comes up is Steve Pierce. A former member of the House, Pierce lost twice for the Senate, including in 2008 when Udall beat him, and was the unsuccessful GOP nominee for governor last year. John Sanchez, the former lieutenant governor, has also been mentioned. Udall is the son of the late Arizona congressman and Kennedy cabinet member Stuart Udall, and the nephew of the late Mo Udall, who succeeded his brother Stuart in the House and ran for president in 1976. He's also the cousin of Mark Udall, a Colorado Democrat who was elected to the Senate along with Tom in 2008, but was defeated after one term in 2014. If you're with me this far, then stay with me for this week's trivia question. Before the Udalls, who were the last relatives who served in the Senate at the same time? Send your answer to trivia@krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia@krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question later in the show, so stay tuned.
Come on, let's go, go, go. What a groovy show. Come on and go, go, go.
With Cousin Bruce.
say.
Duke defeating UCF by just 1 point may have been pretty insane, but the real March Madness last weekend was waiting for and the reaction to the Mueller report. Or, as it turned out, the reaction to Attorney General William Barr's 4-page summary of the Mueller report. Still, everyone wanted to know the answer to the obvious question.
Because people have got to know whether or not their president is a crook.
And do we know the answer now? President Trump thinks so.
There was no collusion with Russia. There was no obstruction, and none whatsoever. And it was a complete and total exoneration.
Since no one knows what's actually in the report, other than Mueller and Barr, everyone seemed to come to their own conclusions, which probably were set in stone well before the weekend. Unsurprisingly, Trump called it a total exoneration when, in fact, one of the key points in the report, quote, does not exonerate the president when it comes to obstruction of justice. Still, the news, or at least what we think we know, courtesy of Mr. Barr, is good for the White House. No more indictments, no more subpoenas, from Mueller anyway. And impeachment is off the table, which is a blow to many in the Democratic left wing. But that's hardly the end of it. Republicans are not only crowing, they're going after the Democrats and the media as liars who should be ashamed of themselves. There were demands that Adam Schiff, who heads up the House Intelligence Committee, should resign as chairman or even leave Congress altogether. Even the president took it a step further, as he is wont to do.
There are a lot of people out there that have done some very, very evil things, very bad things, I would say treasonous things against our country. And hopefully that people that have done such harm to our country, we've gone through a period of really bad things happening. Those people will certainly be looked at. I've been looking at them for a long time, and I'm saying, why haven't they been looked at? They lied to Congress. Many of them, you know who they are. They've done so many evil things. I will tell you, I love this country. I love this country as much as I can love anything. My family, my country, my God. But what they did, it was a false narrative. It was a terrible thing. We can never let this happen to another president again. I can tell you that. I say it very strongly.
Mueller's job may be complete, but the politics is just beginning. And for that, we have Ken Walsh, the White House correspondent and political analyst for U.S. News. Ken, it's great having you back on The Political Junkie.
Thanks for having me, Ken.
Well, you know, the heart-racing anticipation for this report was palpable. Now that we got the report, actually, we got Barr's summary of it, but I guess the question is, what have we learned and what do we still not know?
Right. Well, there's a lot we don't know. And I think one thing I think we have to do here is to step back and sort of take a lot of what's being said now with a grain of salt in that this was an investigation. President Trump wanted to discount it from the beginning, calling it a witch hunt many, many times. I think the Democrats invested too much in the idea that Mueller was going to come up with devastating information that would lead somehow to the removal of President Trump. But it was an investigation. The whole point is to find out what happened. Now we're getting a sense of the conclusions. The idea that this was a foregone conclusion from the beginning, I think, is really a false narrative, because I've come to respect Robert Mueller. I think that he is a very good prosecutor. He has a distinguished career. This group did what they were supposed to do. They looked into this. They spent 22 months looking into it, and then now they've issued a report. We don't really know what's in the report. Attorney General Barr issued this very controversial 4-page summary over the weekend, and he said that there was no finding of collusion. We still don't know about the obstruction part. What's happened is that everybody has become more entrenched in their perceptions and their accusations, and it's resulted in, actually, I think, a worse political climate than we had before last weekend's disclosures.
So I think we agree on several things. First of all, we agree that Trump's victory lap, as everyone is calling it, that's premature, correct?
I believe so, yes.
And but would you also agree that at least this weekend, from what we heard from Attorney General Barr and what you're saying about Barr's role in the administration is absolutely true, but it felt like, and tell me if you agree, it felt like the best day ever for him, at least since he was elected in 2016.
Well, I think that in the situation we have now, this is a good outcome for President Trump so far, because the collusion stuff has been put to the side, we believe. But it's the problem, it's the obstruction part that remains. So I think the whole point is that we're not only in the position of that rabid partisanship that we were in before last weekend, but I think it's worse, and I think it's going to get worse.
And it also, at the same time, it doesn't feel like any minds have been changed.
No, I don't think any minds have been changed. I think another point I think here is that President Trump is now emboldened in many ways. He's found this sort of magic bullet now in saying he's been supported, that there's no collusion with Russia, which apparently the report does say. So he's going to use that to say the whole thing is over. The scandal, the controversy is over. And so I think this is going to be used by everybody, really, to further this atmosphere we have of distrust and really contempt for the other side. And I think that's what it is. I think these people in politics today are so cynical that they have contempt for the other side. It's not just opposition. And you see that every day from President Trump, and the Democrats are starting to do the same thing.
How crucial do you think it is for the Democrats, but also for the truth, to have the full Mueller report come out and not just have what Bill Barr says it is?
Oh, I think it's really essential. I think, by saying the full report, I can understand redacting or blotting out information that may put, means and ways in national security or people who supported us in the intelligence areas in jeopardy, or some national security issues.
Grand jury testimony,
yes,
also.
And grand jury testimony. Yeah. I can understand redacting that. But I think things like conclusions and statements of what people did, there's many of that kind of bits of information that's in there that I think we need to see. So, as a journalist, of course, one would expect I would say that. But I think more generally, this has been going on for so long, and there's such important issues going on here about colluding with another country, about obstruction of justice, where we had a president and President Nixon. We played a clip from him earlier. That was an essential part of the case against President Nixon, the obstruction of justice. So these are very important issues. So I do think the country really needs to see as much of this report as we can without getting into, jeopardizing people's lives and security or national security issues or grand jury testimony. So I do think that it needs to come out. I'm not sure it will. I think that it may turn out that you'll have a constitutional challenge here with the legislative branch against the executive branch, that the Supreme Court will decide in whether this should come out. And that's a case where President Trump, of course, has named two justices who probably will support his position, I would think. So he might have the final say in this through the Supreme Court, in that the report won't be released, but that doesn't mean it won't be pursued. And you also have the whole media network, the media system, trying to get into this too. So that's the other factor we haven't mentioned, how much role the media might play in getting this report out or finding pieces of it. You have some of the best reporters in the business who are going to be looking at this, and I have a feeling that we're going to see a lot of what's in that report or what Mueller found come out through media reports that we haven't seen.
Well, we talk about, yes, there's a House Judiciary Committee investigation, and we know that the Southern District of New York is also looking into it. But ultimately, I think this is really going to be decided in November of 2020.
But what I think will happen, and this is, again, a big impact of this, is how far all sides are now sort of deepening their rancor toward each other. And you might see that play out on this healthcare issue. And that's where the 2020 election will be so important, of course, really all important for the Trump presidency. If he pushes too hard in one way or another and goes way beyond what the country will tolerate, and that may be what will happen with healthcare, then I think we'll look back on this Mueller report as a time when President Trump sort of leaped over the fence and started running really in places that the country didn't want him to go.
But there's also, I think it's fair to say, that there's also a warning to Democrats, perhaps to the more progressive left wing of the party, who want to go after President Trump 24/7, and maybe voters might get tired of that too. You know, people who feel that perhaps the leadership is not aggressive enough, is not confrontational enough, and that could turn voters off to the Democrats as well.
Yeah, that's exactly right, and you are seeing a lot of that now. The talk about impeachment has faded, but that doesn't mean it won't come back. And a lot of the real firebrands in the party, including some of the members just elected last November, are really still just hammering at President Trump constantly. Now, that may be what their constituents want in their districts in the House, but a lot of Americans don't like this idea. And so they're being emboldened from the left, where their people want them to keep pushing and hammering and blocking President Trump as much as they can. But again, we get to that point of, is this really what most Americans want, is a complete breakdown in consensus, or even the attempt to find consensus, which is what we've thought that politics was supposed to be from the beginning of the country's, through the country's founding. You know, are we going to be in a period of paralysis here as far as getting anything done in Congress? And then does that just make President Trump more willing to use executive authority? I think it will. And I think that's a real danger for him, that he's going to be seeing what's happened with Mueller as a license to further amass executive power and to take action because he can't get the system to work for him in other ways. And I think that's going to be a big issue that we'll be talking about right through the next election.
Ken Walsh is the White House correspondent for U.S. News, where he's also their political analyst. Ken, thanks for colluding with the Political Junkie.
Thanks for having me.
When the truth is found to be lies, and all the joy within you dies, don't you want somebody to love? Don't you need somebody to love? Wouldn't you love somebody to love? You better find somebody to love.
Come Tuesday, history is going to be made in Chicago. Two black women will be running against each other in a runoff, the winner to become the next mayor of the Windy City. It was history in 1983 when Harold Washington was elected Chicago's first African-American mayor.
Today, Chicago has seen the bright daybreak for this city and for perhaps this entire country. The whole nation is watching as Chicago has sent a powerful message.
But in the 8 elections following his death in 1987, the winner was a white candidate, first Richard M. Daley, and then Rahm Emanuel. This year, that will change. This time, two black women, and one is openly gay, which would also be a first. Cheryl Corley is an NPR correspondent based in Chicago and has been covering the election. Cheryl, it's great having you on The Political Junkie.
Thank you, Ken, and it was great hearing that Harold Washington bite, because I'm old enough to remember all of that. Harold Washington is somewhat of a factor in this race as well. As you mentioned, he was the first black mayor and about to make history here with another first.
Well, exactly. That's exactly the thing I was trying to get to, because when you heard Harold Washington talking about that powerful message, Tuesday's election, this coming Tuesday's election, may not have the historic pull of what happened in 1983, but it will be a first.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a first that nobody really expected. We have two candidates. People pretty much thought the more establishment one, Cook County Board President Tony Preckwinkle, was possibly going to be, the person who was either going to be successful the first time around or in a runoff, which she was able to get into. But nobody had any idea that Lori Lightfoot, who is the second candidate in this runoff, was going to be the successful candidate. In fact, at the top of the heap of 14 candidates, and that we were going to have these two African-American women kind of facing off against each other.
And Lori Lightfoot is the gay candidate. I mean, I don't want to call her the gay candidate, but she happens to be openly gay, which would also be a first.
Absolutely. Uh-huh.
And when you talked about those 14 candidates, I mean, my goodness, there were so many famous names from the establishment led by Bill Daley. And the fact that all these candidates lost, that had to be a shock to the system, right?
I think it absolutely was. And, you know, I think that initially folks thought, you know, Daley was going to make it into the runoff round, absolutely because that famous name, which may have actually been a factor that didn't help him as much. But I think the whole thing was because it was historic in another way that we had 14 candidates running in this race, so you had such a split in the vote. Historic also because we had so many people of color running, so many women running, an openly gay candidate running. So, you know, it was an election that we had never seen before in the city of Chicago, and ending up with this two-person runoff race.
It almost sounds pretty similar to what we saw last year in Congress, with so many women getting elected, so many people of color, so many people with different sexual orientation. It's kind of representing America.
Yeah, I think so. And you did see that kind of filter down into the city, and a kind of a wide open election with people really wanting to see some change, all made possible because of Rahm Emanuel making the decision not to run for another term. And I think that had a lot to do with the negatives that had come during his campaign that started with the publicity that flared when a young African-American man, Laquan McDonald, was shot by a white police officer who has subsequently been convicted of murder. But a lot of people thought that Rahm Emanuel and his administration kind of covered that up when he was running for mayor the second time around, and that kind of plagued his administration, his second term, despite some of the other things that he was doing as mayor of Chicago.
So I assume it's fair to say that both crime and police conduct are two major issues in this election.
Absolutely, absolutely. In fact, Lori Lightfoot kind of made her mark with police reform. She was the head of the Chicago Police Board and also the head of this police accountability task force that was formed as a result of the Laquan McDonald shooting. And that task force also brought the Department of Justice into town, which took a look at Chicago and said, you know, you need to have reform here. There's a consent decree now that Chicago has negotiated with the Illinois Attorney General, not the Department of Justice. And I could go into all of that, but that would put us in the weeds. but yes, police reform, crime, that is absolutely a big issue here in the city, as well as the other big thing is the city's financial condition and the pensions that have really saddled the city with a big financial mess here that the next mayor, whoever she may be, is going to have to struggle with.
We always used to say he or she may be. It's who she may be, right?
I know. It's now just a plain old she.
Plain old she. Do are Lightfoot and Preckwinkle talking about different solutions, or do they kind of see the issues the same way?
You know, it's really been interesting with them because it's a battle over who is the most progressive, right? And they do talk the same in a lot of ways. They are both considered to be progressive candidates and talk about crime in the same way and some of the things that they would do about that, talk about education in the same way, affordable housing in the same way. A lot of it has to do with style and who these folks are. Tony Preckwinkle is a person who has been around Chicago politics for a very long time. She served in the city council for several years, almost 20 years. She's been president of the Cook County Board for 8 years. And so she is seen as kind of this progressive reformer who is now the kind of new political boss in the city of Chicago. She's also the head of the Cook County Democratic Party. So she touts her experience, but she also has all of the baggage that comes with being a person who's been in office for so long. And Lori Lightfoot likes to say, you know, I am the candidate of change. So what we have here is this battle between these two women, one who says, you know, I'm experienced, I know how government should operate, I've been able to balance budgets, and this newcomer who says, you know, I've managed budgets too, but I know more about crime and how to solve the kinds of issues that the city is going to face. I'm a candidate of change, and that's why you should elect me.
The fact that Lightfoot is talking about herself as a candidate of change, does that account for the sizable lead she seems to have in the polls?
I think so. It's an incredible lead, especially when you think of Toni Preckwinkle and the kind of support that she has been able to have in the past. But yeah, I do think that people are interested. You know, you were talking about what we've seen on the national scene with the types of candidates who have been elected and the new folks who are coming into political office. And I think the same kind of thing is happening here in the city, that people are looking for something different, and that people who have been in office for a while are seen as, you know, these kind of entrenched candidates, and people are saying, you know, time to look at something new.
With all the things we're talking about, with all the issues at stake, and with all the fact that history is going to be made, or could be, will be made, they're still talking about low turnout, perhaps record low turnout. That's, of course, disappointing, but what do we say about that?
Yeah, it is disappointing, and it's very interesting in the fact that, you know, it's a historic election. So I think it's going to be kind of interesting to see what the vote is this time around. During the first part of this election, I thought it was kind of understandable just because there was this plethora of candidates, and I think a lot of people were just overwhelmed or thought that, you know, I'm just going to wait until, you know, I have two people that I'm going to choose between. And so that's why we saw such a low turnout, I think, the first time around. So I think it's really going to be interesting to see what happens this second time and, you know, who's going to benefit from what could be a low turnout.
Cheryl Corley is the Midwest correspondent for NPR based in Chicago. Cheryl, it's always great to hear your voice.
It's great to talk to you, Ken.
I'm making my way back to Chicago. I'm making my way, come rain or shine. I'm gonna find true love waiting for me. Gonna make it all on the road tonight. Take one.
It's time to reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question, which was, who was the first declared presidential candidate ever to appear on Saturday Night Live? I don't know if I have the definitive answer on this. Yes, President Ford was on the program in 1976, but he appeared as an incumbent president, not merely a candidate. But I'll accept Ford as an answer. Several people guessed Jesse Jackson, who was first on SNL in October of 1984. But his candidacy was long over by then. Same with George McGovern, who hosted the program in April of 1984, a month after he dropped out of the race.
Thank you. Thank you for that wonderful reception. Where were you last month on Super Tuesday?
So unless I'm proven wrong, I'm going with Bruce Babbitt as the correct answer. Babbitt, the former governor of Arizona, appeared on the program on October 17, 1987, as he was seeking the Democratic presidential nomination. I can't find video of that performance, but it was back during a time when other Democrats were caught in the middle of controversies. And in this sketch, Al Franken notified Babbitt that he was caught in a supermarket checkout line with 11 items in a 10 items or less line. Anyway, Mark Friedman of New Orleans had Bruce Babbitt as the answer. He wins the coveted political junkie button. And don't forget, we still have a scuttle button puzzle out there waiting to be solved. You can find that, as well as our political blogs, trivia questions, and the Political Junkie store, all on our website, krpoliticaljunkie.com.
Laugh, laugh, authorita. It seems so funny to me. Laugh, laugh, you better guy. Who taught you how to be lonely? Lonely, oh so lonely.
It's time for This Week in Political History. She was a rising star in the Democratic Party, and she made history at the 1984 Democratic National Convention.
Ladies and gentlemen of the convention, my name is Geraldine Ferraro.
In 1984, Geraldine Ferraro, a three-term congresswoman from Queens, became the first woman named to a major party ticket. The Democratic team of Walter Mondale and Ferraro went on to lose 49 states to Republicans Ronald Reagan and George Bush that year. But on that July evening in San Francisco, she changed politics forever. Her later success in politics, unfortunately, never matched the excitement of that moment. And it was 8 years ago this week that she died from multiple myeloma. But back in 1984, Judy Goldsmith was the president of the National Organization for Women, a group that was lobbying Mondale to pick a female running mate. Judy was on the floor of the convention that summer and is here to talk about that moment. Judy Goldsmith, it's wonderful having you on The Political Junkie.
Well, it's a real pleasure to be back, Ken. Thank you.
Well, today we have more women in the halls of Congress than ever before. In 2016, there was the first woman nominated for president on a major party ticket, a woman who won the popular vote in November. And in many ways, it all seemed to start with Geraldine Ferraro.
Yes, I think it really did. And it has exploded, hasn't it? It's very exciting to see what's happening in Congress and around the country.
Well, if you go back to 1984, or even before that convention, I remember there was a lot of lobbying going on in the weeks leading up to the convention to get Mondale to choose a woman for the ticket. How did that campaign begin, and what was NOW's, you know, the National Organization for Women, what was their role in it?
Okay, well, we felt very strongly that we needed a different president than Ronald Reagan. His record on women's issues had been abysmal. And so we did a lot of research on what kind of candidate would most likely appeal to people as Walter Mondale's running mate. And what we came up with, just time and time again, as well as other organizations finding, that the appeal of a woman on the ticket was tremendous, that it made a real difference in people's attitudes as opposed to the old two white guys on the ticket. So we did a lot of research and found that a woman on the ticket was exciting to people. And starting from that point, we started interviewing candidates who were presidential nominees at that time for the Democratic Party. But Walter Mondale was chosen, and we met with him. We talked with him about our research.
There was a fear. I remember there's a fear among some Democrats that if Mondale picked a woman, you know, he would have been seen as knuckling under pressure. And if he didn't, there would be a revolt on the floor. Is that assessment too harsh?
Oh, boy. Yeah. And isn't it a typical sexist reaction that if he chooses a woman, he will be seen as less of a man and buckling to a woman, when in fact it was a very strong, courageous decision to make? And as to whether there would have been a demonstration on the floor, I highly doubt that. That's all conjecture at this point. But we were concerned with having a winning ticket, and we felt that a woman on the ticket would be the strongest. But that didn't happen, so we didn't have to worry about that.
A few years ago, I had Mondale on The Political Junkie, and I asked him about his running mate decision.
I spent a lot of time reviewing who I might pick as a running mate. And as I got down to it, I decided that Ferraro would help in so many ways. First of all, she's bright. She had an excellent record in the Congress. Tip O'Neill told me she's the person you need. And I was hoping that she would give some life to the process. You know, one of the big problems in politics is boredom. And this offered to America an entirely different version of what America should be about. And I think, although we got clobbered, I think that the message was sent that was deep and profound.
You know, Walter Mondale mentioned the word boredom. That convention in San Francisco was anything but boring.
Really? Yes, it was explosive. Could I share with you a couple of paragraphs from an editorial that appeared in our National Now Times after the conference that sort of captures the spirit?
Please.
Okay, this is from the editorial. A tidal wave of emotion had swept the cavernous interior of the Moscone Center, where the convention was held. Congresswoman Barbara Cannelli, her face alight with a radiance and pride probably unparalleled in the history of nominating speeches, fairly shouted into the microphone, "I nominate Geraldine Ferraro for Vice President of the United States." The band was playing, we can't remember what, and smiles and tears intermingled on people's faces as they kept up the jubilant chant, "We want Jerry." It is the faces that will stay forever fixed in our mind, like photographs in an album, the hundreds, thousands of faces upturned toward the podium, shining with the joyous disbelief we had felt since Walter Mondale made his historic choice 1 week earlier. On that day, July 12, 1984, he had stood in the rotunda of the Minnesota State Capitol and said, "I searched for the best vice president, and I found her in Jerry Ferraro." The word "her" hung in the air like a new word, one we had never heard before.
You know, as I'm listening to you read that, I mean, I remember I'm suddenly being thrown back to the floor of the convention where I was. That was my first Democratic convention, and there I was on the floor, and I remember watching the tears in the eyes of all the women on the floor. It was just emotional, remarkable, and I still remember it to this day, of course.
Yeah, it was powerful, and it was, I think, so spontaneous in the quick recording that you played at the beginning, that little clip of what happened when she said hello. The crowd absolutely erupted. It was quite remarkable. So yeah, it was an unforgettable moment.
Well, let me play a little more of that speech.
I stand before you to proclaim tonight, America is the land where dreams can come true for all of us. As I stand before the American people and think of the honor this great convention has bestowed upon me, I recall the words of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who made America stronger by making America more free. He said, "Occasionally in life, there are moments which cannot be completely explained by words. Their meaning can only be articulated by the inaudible language of the heart. Tonight is such a moment for me."
Judy, she talked about heart. You still feel that, don't you?
Oh, it is just lovely to go back there and hear that. Yeah, it was unforgettable. Beautiful.
Did you ever think that the Mondale Ferraro ticket was going to win, or was that not even the point?
Oh, no, we definitely thought he was going to. I mean, that was what we were concerned about. There were some people who said initially that we were selling out by fighting for a woman on the ticket, but our research had found that any male candidate would not have created any excitement, really, any. As Mondale said in the clip you played, there was a sense of it being boring. Well, this took that problem away. So that was why we planned to. And initially, for the first few days, there was a terrific boost in the polls. It was just, you know, it skyrocketed. But then the attacks began. And the attacks were, I won't say unlike anything we've ever seen in politics, because, of course, that wouldn't be true. But they were fierce and virulent and attacked very, reporters, some reporters, went back two generations trying to dig dirt on Ferraro to find something because they found it very difficult. What they finally ended up doing was scrutinizing her husband, who was in real estate, microscopically, and found some things that seemed inappropriate. No candidate's husband, of course, had ever been scrutinized like that. It was the first time that a candidate on the top of the ticket had a husband. But it was really dirty pool, and it was followed by another attack that I felt was what really lost a lot of women's support, and that was the claim, and this was hammered home over and over again, and that was a call to women saying to them, to women who wanted to vote for her, are you really saying you'll vote for her just because she's a woman? And that was devastating to women because women are conditioned from birth, from childhood, to always put other people before them, their husband before them, their children before them. So the idea that women would actually do something in their own interest was shocking. And certainly nobody ever asked a man or anyone if they voted against her just because she's a woman. But of course, that was acceptable. That, I think, was a major part of what created the negative frame around the candidacy.
I was going to say, well, one of the claims or the charges of being condescending about Geraldine Ferraro came in that memorable moment in the Bush-Ferraro vice presidential debate.
Let me help you with the difference, Ms. Ferraro, between Iran and the embassy in Lebanon. Iran, we were held by a foreign government. In Lebanon, you had a wanton terrorist action where the government opposed it. We went to Lebanon to give peace a chance, to stop the bombing of civilians in Beirut, to remove 13,000 terrorists from Lebanon. We did. We saw the formation of a government of reconciliation, and for somebody to suggest, as our two opponents have, that these men died in shame, they better not tell the parents of those young Marines. They gave peace a chance. And our allies were with us, the British, the French, and the Italians.
Congresswoman Ferraro.
Let me just say, first of all, that I almost resent, Vice President Bush, your patronizing attitude that you have to teach me about foreign policy. I've been a member of Congress for 6 years. I was there when the embassy was held hostage in Iran, and I have been there, and I have seen what has happened in the past several months, 17 months, with your administration.
Judy, that's basically that's exactly what you were referring to.
That was the ultimate in condescension. His saying, let me help you, Mrs. Ferraro, as if she needed help. And also Mrs. Ferraro, not Congresswoman Ferraro. I mean, it couldn't have been more obvious and gross. And yeah, and a number of people picked that up. But of course, the nation was still largely conditioned to that kind of attitude at that time. So it didn't necessarily create the shock that it did for us.
We always say that vice presidents, for the most part, don't make a difference in deciding an election. Did Ferraro make a difference?
Oh, yes, absolutely. One thing I recall, and I don't have the specifics, I don't have the figures, but we were told that the Democratic National Coordinating Committee took in a much greater number of contributions in the weeks and months after that, after the convention, because of the excitement level. And it was absolutely true. Jerry got phone calls from lots of people, letters. She said that referred to a letter that a woman wrote to her saying that when she heard that Jerry had been nominated, she ran upstairs to the bedroom of her sleeping daughters and told them the good news. She said her daughters were only 2 years old at the time and not very impressed, but that she would tell them later on and they would remember. So, yeah, it was great. It was remarkable. It did absolutely help. I can't imagine that anything much differently would have happened in terms of the outcome if Mondale had not picked Ferraro.
In later years, I remember you once told me that you've had conversations with her about the historic nature of that moment. Can you talk a little bit about that?
It was electrifying for her. It was chilling. You know, it impressed me because I was, of course, standing there watching. It impressed me that she was able to even speak with the emotion of the moment. But she was excellent. She was controlled. She was clearly passionate, but that did not in any way distort or affect her delivery. She felt that it was a moment unlike any she had ever experienced, and that in many ways, a moment unlike anything our nation had experienced, that it was historic, not just for her, but for the nation.
Judy Goldsmith was president of the National Organization for Women back in 1984, when Geraldine Ferraro made history by becoming the first woman to appear on a major party ticket. Judy, thank you so much for sharing your memories.
Oh, thank you, Ken. I enjoyed it very much, as I always enjoy your comments in Facebook.
Well, before you go, I want to play a little piece of tape from Judy Goldsmith from 1984.
In choosing Geraldine Ferraro to be his running mate, Walter Mondale has made the kind of bold, progressive move that will propel the Democratic ticket to victory in November. The Mondale-Ferraro ticket will provide a daily visible reminder of the contrast between Walter Mondale, the candidate dedicated to breaking down the barriers that women and minorities face, and Ronald Reagan, the candidate determined to create new ones. Mondale's choice reaffirms his sound political judgment, his refusal to allow gender to bar the best candidate, and his historic and unprecedented commitment to equality for all the citizens of this nation. We are prouder today of the Now PAC endorsement of Walter Mondale than we have ever been before, and we are confident of victory in November.
It was 8 years ago this week, on March 26, 2011, that Geraldine Ferraro died of multiple myeloma, an incurable form of blood cancer. She was 75 years old.
A terrible loss. You know, one little footnote to all of this, Ken. One thing that excited us when we first learned about Ferraro was that her birthday was August 26th, which is the anniversary of the passage of suffrage, the suffrage amendment. We always called it Women's Equality Day. And then to find that that was also Jerry's birthday was pretty exciting.
Judy, it was so great having you on the show.
Wonderful, my friend. Good to hear from you.
That's it for this week's show. Be sure to check out our website for much more political content and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. It's all at krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to Ken at krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or follow the show on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. Political Junkie is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. The show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins, and Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer and engineer. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening. See you next week.